it's time for the Des Moines Register on Thursday, February 29, Leap Day. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and from donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. AccuWeather says that across the state will be windy and mild today with plenty of sun. A bit warm up on the way. Winds south-southwest 15 to 25 miles per hour. Windy in the evening. Clear tonight. And the forecast through the weekend for central Iowa looks like this. Today, windy and mild with plenty of sun and a big warm up on the way. Winds south-southwest 15 to 25 miles per hour. Clear tonight. A high today of 55 and a low of 35. Tomorrow on Friday, look for a mostly breezy and sunny day with a high of 58 and a low of 40. On Saturday, mostly sunny and warmer, a high of 69 and a low of 53. And on Sunday, looks like spring is back with a high of 77, a low of 41, warm and sunshiny. Looking at precipitation in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Wednesday, we did have a trace of precipitation in central Iowa. The month to date, we've had 42 hundredths of an inch against a normal of 1.34 inches. Our year to date has been 2.33 inches against a normal of 2.42 inches. And last year at this time, we'd had 3.65 inches of precipitation. In the snowfall, the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Wednesday, we did have a trace. The month to date has seen 4.2 inches. Our normal month to date is 10.2 inches. The season to date has been 34.2 inches, and our normal season to date is 30.7 inches. Sunrise today, 6:50 a.m. Sunset tonight, 6:04 p.m. Moonrise today, 11:25 p.m., with moon set today at 8:55 a.m. Well, looking at the extremes of temperature across the state, it does look like we had a little bit more winter. We ranged from a high of 34 in Red Oak, to a low of minus one at Sibley. And nationally, there was a big gap between 88 high in Plant City, Florida, and a low of minus 21 in Crested Butte, Colorado. Now, turning to the headlines on the front page of the Register. The lead story has a picture spread, and it says, from vintage to vibrant, the Valour Ballroom reopens today after massive renovation. The other headlines read like this, Forum gives voice to at-large candidates, and McConnell to quit as the Senate GOP leader. And now here with the first story is Linda.
Well, I'll read the story about the Valair Ballroom. It says it reopens today after massive renovation. For 84 years, West Des Moines' Valair Ballroom welcomed anyone from Bobby Soxers to metalheads looking for a night on the town. Frank Sinatra, Snoop Dogg, and former presidents are among the dozens of famous names who walked the concert venue's maplewood floor as the ballroom survived decades of musical trends and the long journey from 78 records to online streaming. Just when the ballroom finally appeared to be on its last legs, local entrepreneur Sam Summers stepped into the role of conservationist, investor, and now a potential visionary. He looked beyond the peeling paint and code violations to create a destination venue for the entire state. Summers' company bought the 8.5-acre site at 301 Ashworth Road for $1.9 million in 2022, receiving a decaying building infused with local history and memories, and also the worrying potential to become a money pit. But a reported $14.5 million in renovations later, Summers is confidently set to relaunch the ballroom today, an appropriate leap day for a space with a hallowed jump and jive legacy. We want people to come in and not see things that are wrong with the space. When I came to shows here over the years, my staff or myself would feel like there were deficiencies in the space. And so we want people to come in and just feel like it should, Summers explained. There are no lines. It feels great in here, and you can see the band. You can hear the band. The co-owner of Woolies, the 683-person capacity venue in the East Village, founded First Fleet Concerts, which will be booking the ballroom's events, plus the Hinterland Music Festival and East Village Watering Holes, Up Down Arcade Bar, and Ernie's Boondock. He also books shows for the new Vibrant Music Hall in Waukee. He began promoting concerts while a student at Iowa State University, and despite the time-consuming and undepictable nature of the live music business, I think that's unpredictable, he remains a passionate fan of music and the live concert experience. Original Valair Ballroom owner Thomas Archer transformed the bankrupt Wilson Rubber Company property into a ballroom in 1939. Generations of Iowans recall visits for high school events, social occasions, and its core business as a 2,500-ticket capacity music venue. Summers has worked closely with Archer's descendants to preserve as much of its past as possible, but some changes were inevitable to conform to modern health and safety considerations. New electrical, plumbing, safety sprinklers, and ADA-compliant accessibility ensure the venue is set for the future, while still honoring the good bones and character of the vintage setting. Once ticket holders enter the ballroom's front doors, security will guide the audience through metal scanners and direct guests up the stairs to the main room. During the construction phase, Summers found two swatches of an earlier color scheme and adopted mint green for the walls and a salmon pink for hardtop surfaces and accents. The interior is partially illuminated by mid-century wall sconces and vintage light fixtures rescued from years of neglect. And the lounge has been attached to the ladies' bathroom to add an unexpected corner of retro glamour and a potential setting for photo shoots. The venue's broad and diverse booking policy will not be altered under Summers' ownership. A smaller stage on the side of the main hall was previously used for corporate events and stump speeches by political figures, including Senator Ted Kennedy, and former presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. We've got pictures of the Secret Service on the roof, Summers said, referencing a cache of memorabilia, posters, and documents the Archer family shared with the team. Summers sees that podium as a possible venue for smaller touring acts and national cultural figures to give talks. He's even considering producing live albums recorded direct from the stage and put out a double record. So when I have more time, I'll do that. Parties, wedding receptions, and corporate events are quickly on their way back. Just today, someone reached out about a Christmas Eve service for 2,000 people. Some of the big conferences used to be here. Food and beverage festivals are trying to come here, he said during a tour of the space on February 22nd. For performers, the backstage area has been retooled with a generous amount of space, curtained off from the audience. Valair staff have not been neglected and now have access to their own off-shift areas, offices, and bathrooms. Before the ballroom closed for reinventions in 2022, singer-songwriter Jason Isbell played one of the final scheduled concerts and will be one of the first to witness the makeover. We have him coming on March 6, Summers explained. He actually played right before we closed down, so I hope to get his feedback on it. The general admission setup for the majority of acts can be quickly converted to an all-seating show, depending on the performer and the type of audience. The cavernous basement can easily store the seats that will be used for the upcoming Joe Pera comedy show on June 16th, and an appearance by classic rockers the Marshall Tucker Band and Jefferson Starship on April 26th. Pera's hushed, slow, and steady delivery will provide a perfect test of Valair's new L'Acoustique sound system, a French brand favored by sound engineers, the X-booked live venue in the Drake neighborhood, and discerning touring bands, including Slipknot. Working closely with preservationists, Summers and his team were granted permission to raise the height above the stage to enable the installation of a lighting rig and create an uncluttered view of the backdrop. The stage itself was also raised 6 to 8 inches, making all the action easier to watch from the back of the room. The maple wood floor has been restored and reinforced, but once the lights go down, concert goers won't necessarily notice the difference, aside from a slight, pleasantly bouncy feel under their feet. Mindful of being a good neighbor, insulation has been added to the roof to prevent concert sounds bleeding into the surrounding streets. During its earliest incarnation, the venue was literally open to the sky. Dance Under the Stars, 1930s advertising encouraged. The design inspired the Air part of the Val Air name, sandwiched next a nod to its close vicinity to Valley Junction. And everyone inside will appreciate the long-awaited overhaul of the air conditioning system. Eager to have a few events underway to dial in the sound and guest management, Summers already has bold plans mapped for the remainder of the year. A speakeasy-inspired bar and restaurant on the basement level could be completed as early as September. He would love the space to partner with a local restaurateur and frame a menu around Midwestern supper club favorites. And inspired by Santa Fe, New Mexico, creatives Meow Wolf, a handful of potential interactive focal points, are buzzing around his mind, designed to surprise ticket buyers, either at the front desk or around the hall. Practical improvements will continue to evolve over time, including hand-painted signs, QR code drink ordering at the seated tables, and outdoor landscaping. The Valair Ballroom's famed signage is already switched on, upgraded with LED illuminations to replace fragile and disintegrating neon. Valair's earliest days brought thousands to dance to big band beats. As a teen idol, Frank Sinatra wowed a Bobby Soxer audience during a 1942 appearance. And Lawrence Welk, a close friend of Archer, frequently brought his orchestra back for return engagements. Outside the ballroom, a large cursive sign encouraging dancing has been left intact for a new generation. People are so uptight now, I don't think they dance, But I will say, the Latin shows we do, there are bands playing, and it's a lot more dance-forward. Oh, it's cool, Summers said. He maintains a long personal wish list of musicians he would like to return to the new and improved stage. Top of the current roster is Iowa's own Slipknot, who previously packed 2,530 rabid fans into the ballroom in 2004. Launching their 25th anniversary tour in Europe later this year, Summers had made it clear to their representatives he would dearly love for the band to choose the Valair for a homecoming event. Another dream headliner would be Bob Dylan, who once played a set list of classics at the ballroom back in 2006. Summers is patient that Dylan's never-ending tour schedule will wind its way back to West Des Moines. I'm sure that will happen eventually, he said. Summers hopes the opening with Green Sky Bluegrass will provide a chance to meet former patrons who remember the ballroom during its glory years. I'll be curious to see who comes out to our soft opening, to hear stories from people about who they saw, what they came for. A lot of school dances were hosted here.
And I'm going to tell on you, Linda just said, pointed to herself and said, mine was held there. Well, it's nice to know the Valair is coming back. Here's our next story. Forum gives voice to at-large candidates. Six at-large Des Moines City Council candidates shared their views on homelessness, the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority system, and climate change during a forum ahead of the March 19 special election. At-large candidates Dr. Claudia Andy, Benjamin Clark, Justin Lewis, Robert, known as Bobby Pate, Mike Simonson, and Rose Marie Smith gathered Monday at the Brody Middle School Auditorium at 2501 Park Avenue. More than 40 people attended the roughly 90-minute forum, where the candidates had 2 minutes each to answer pre-written questions read by moderator George Davis, the Southwestern Hills Neighborhood Association president, before the public was given time to ask questions. The special election is set for March 19. Early voting began February 28. Among the issues and responses, and before I begin addressing this, let me tell you that a little later we'll have a rundown of more details about the backgrounds of the candidates themselves who are running in the at-large election. But here's a rundown of what happened around the issues at the forum. The DART service and budget issues. Given the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority's request for the City of Des Moines to provide additional funding through a franchise fee, Davis asked the candidates to provide their views and concerns over DART services, benches at bus stops, weekend service, and trash pickup at the stops. Lewis, a business owner and activist, said it's important to ask why DART needs funding from Des Moines in the first place. His answer, DART is a regional system, and if we're looking at all the people in our region, not everyone is putting in as equitably as they should. He said the city should elect someone who supports DART, but also advocates for improving the agency's quality of services and how it manages its budget. Clark, a farmer and the founder of Iowa Firm Foundation, an education nonprofit, said he'd like to see more shelters at bus stops for inclement weather and would like to see more metro area cities participating in the transit system. He said advocating for more tourism could help attract more customers to the transit system. Pate, an Iowa State government employee and criminal justice reform advocate, said there needs to be more research on whether the amount of DART is asking for is justified before the city makes additional funding decisions. He told the audience public transit is key for residents, especially for those who use it to get to work. Smith said public transit is needed in Des Moines, especially for those whose experience is homelessness and others who rely on the system, regardless of whether suburbs want to participate. She said the city needs to invest where DART's dollars are being spent and ensure the money is used to serve the community. Simonson, an architect, said he is supportive of DART, pointing to a statistic that shows about 61% of people who use the service do not have a car. He applauded a city zoning ordinance that concentrates development along the DART route, saying it is ecologically smart and a good way to encourage people to ride the bus. Like Lewis, Simonson emphasized the transit system is regional, and after meeting with other council members from surrounding suburbs, Simonson said it was encouraging to hear that some also advocate for improving DART services. It cannot be on the shoulders of Des Moines alone, Simonson said. Addy, a retired physician, expressed concerns over a possible increase in the franchise fee to support DART. Still, she said she has good personal experience with the bus system. She suggested the agency start a shuttle option for large downtown events, similar to how the buses are used to shuttle visitors to the state fair, as a way for the agency to pull in additional revenue. On the issue of homelessness and affordable housing, one resident asked the candidates their views on homelessness in the city, panhandling, and the difficulty of finding affordable housing in Des Moines. Pate told the audience homelessness has become an issue across the country and in Iowa, and said in some cases it can cause trauma in children. He said affordable housing should be accessible for vulnerable residents, including people with criminal records. Lewis said it's important to remember to humanize homelessness, noting that everyone deserves to be housed. He said the solution to homelessness is twofold, making sure the person gets housed and gets access to food, a job, and mental health services. Lewis said Des Moines already has some pieces of that puzzle. He said the missing piece is adding more affordable housing and more housing types, such as apartments. Smith applauded the city for its recent hiring of Amber Lewis, a homeless policy administrator, who she hopes will be able to gather information needed to address the issue. Smith, who said homelessness stems from causes such as mental health and a lack of affordable housing, said the city is on its way to tackling the issue. Simonson agreed the city was on the right track in tackling homelessness, pointing to programs such as Restart Recovery Homes, Temporary Housing for Men, and Central Iowa Shelter and Services. He also called out an estimated gap of about 300 units needed for rapid rehousing, permanent housing with transitional subsidies, and on-site services. Simonson said many people fall into homelessness because of a sudden change, such as car bills that lead to losing a job, a relationships change, or health issues. Clark said the city also needs to consider how to help its veterans who are homeless and have an impairment. On the issue of climate change and Adapt Des Moines, climate activist Carolyn Ulaker Walker asked the candidates whether they believe in climate change and what parts of Adapt DSM, the city's new climate action plan, they would promote so that it is not simply sitting on a shelf. Smith says she believes in climate change. She agreed the plan should not sit on the shelf, but she said she would need to do some research on it. Addy said she believes in climate change and said the city has made strides in the right direction. Simonson said he believes in climate change but would need to do additional research on the climate action plan. He said generally plans should become part of an ordinance or specific requirements in order to have teeth. Otherwise, it does become just a plan, he said. Pate said he needs to do more research on climate change, what it means, and what are its pros and cons. He said he would continue to listen and learn. Clark said he also would have to research climate change and said weather changes are what he called up to the Lord. Lewis said he believes in climate change and said he practices conservation through his landscaping business, which specializes in water conservation practices, including soil quality restoration and rain gardens. And finally, on the issue of want to catch an here's the last issue. I was reading the issue headlines. This is an indication that you have an opportunity to hear at-large Des Moines City Council forums again in other times and places. There are more opportunities to hear from the candidates before the special election on March 19. Here are a few of the upcoming events. In East Des Moines, Democrats, 6 p.m. March 6th at Chuck's Restaurant at 3610 6th 6th Avenue. And the Lower Beaver Neighborhood Association at 6:30 p.m. March 7 at Deborah Heights Wesleyan Church, 4025 Lower Beaver Road.
McConnell to quit as Senate GOP leader. Kentucky Republican plans to step down in November. Mitch McConnell, the longest-serving Senate leader in history, who maintained his power in the face of dramatic convulsions in the Republican Party for almost two decades, will step down from that position in November. McConnell, 82, was set to announce his decision Wednesday in the well of the Senate, a place where he looked in awe from its back benches in 1985 when he arrived, and where he grew increasingly comfortable in the front row seat afforded the party leaders. One of life's most underappreciated talents is to know when it's time to move on to life's next chapter, he said in prepared remarks obtained by the Associated Press. So I stand before you today to say that this will be my last term as Republican leader of the Senate. His decision punctuates a powerful ideological transition underway in the Republican Party, from Ronald Reagan's brand of traditional conservatism and strong international alliances to the fiery, often isolationist populism of former President Donald Trump. McConnell said he plans to serve out his Senate term, which ends in January 2027, albeit from a different seat in the chamber. Aides said McConnell's announcement about the leadership post was unrelated to his health. The Kentucky senator had a concussion from a fall last year and two public episodes where his face briefly froze while he was speaking. As I have been thinking about when I would deliver some news to the Senate, I always imagined a moment when I had total clarity and peace about the sunset of my work, McConnell said in his prepared remarks. A moment when I am certain I have helped preserve the ideals I so strongly believe. It arrived today. The senator had been under increasing pressure from the restive and at times hostile wing of his party that has aligned firmly with Trump. The two have been estranged since December 2020, when McConnell refused to abide Trump's lie that the election of Joe Biden was the product of fraud. But while McConnell's critics within the GOP conference had grown louder, their numbers had not grown appreciably larger, a marker of McConnell's strategic and tactical skill and his ability to understand the needs of his fellow Republican senators. McConnell gave no specific reason for the timing of his decision, which he has been contemplating for months, but he cited the recent death of his wife's younger sister as a moment that prompted introspection. The end of my contributions are closer than I'd prefer, McConnell said. He noted that when he arrived in the Senate, I was just happy if anybody remembered my name. During his campaign in 1984, when Reagan was visiting Kentucky, the president called him Mitch O'Donnell. McConnell endorsed Reagan's view of America's role in the world, and the senator has persisted in face of opposition, including from Trump, that Congress should include a foreign assistance package that includes $60 billion for Ukraine. I am unconflicted about the good within our country and the irreplaceable role we play as the leader of the free world, McConnell said. Against long odds, he managed to secure 22 Republican votes for the package now being considered by the House. Believe me, I know the politics within my party at this particular moment in time. I have many faults. Misunderstanding politics is not one of them, McConnell said. That said, I believe more strongly than ever that America's global leadership is essential to preserving the shining city on a hill that Ronald Reagan discussed. For as long as I am drawing breath on this earth, I will defend American exceptionalism. Trump has pulled the party hard to the ideological right, questioning long-time military alliances such as NATO, international trade agreements, and pushing for a severe crackdown on immigration, all the while clinging to the falsehood that the election was stolen from him in 2020. McConnell and Trump had worked together in Trump's first term, remaking the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary in a far more conservative image, and on tax legislation. But there was also friction from the start, with Trump frequently sniping at the senator. Their relationship has essentially been over since Trump refused to accept the results of the Electoral College. But the rupture deepened dramatically after the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. McConnell assigned blame and responsibility to Trump and said that he should be held to account through the criminal justice system for his actions. Critics insist he could have done more, including voting to convict Trump during his second impeachment trial. McConnell did not, arguing that since Trump was no longer in office, he could not be subject to impeachment. Rather than fade from prominence after the Capitol riot, Trump continued to assert his control over the party and finds himself on a clear path to the Republican nomination. Other members of the Republican Senate leadership have endorsed Trump. McConnell has not, and that has drawn criticism from other Republican senators. From the day he walked onto the Senate floor in 1985 and took his seat as the most junior Republican senator, he set his sights on being the party leader. What set him apart was that so many other Senate leaders wanted to run for president. McConnell wanted to run the Senate. He lost races for lower party positions before steadily ascending and finally becoming party leader in 2006, and has won 9 straight elections. He most recently beat back a challenge led by Senator Rick Scott of Florida last November. McConnell built his power base by a combination of care and nurturing of his members, including understanding their political imperatives. After seeing the potential peril of a rising Tea Party, he also established a Super Political Action Committee, the Senate Leadership Fund, which has provided hundreds of millions of dollars in support of Republican candidates. I love the Senate, he said in his prepared remarks. It has been my life. There may be more distinguished members of this body throughout our history, but I doubt there are any with more admiration for it.
And that concludes the stories on the front page of the Des Moines Register. We'll move now to the Metro and Iowa section. Iowa ends AEA Disability Services contract. The Iowa Department of Education has ended a contract with the state's area education agencies for a program that helps families of students with disabilities navigate the services those children need. The Family and Educator Partnership Program will end July 1. The Department of Education informed officials with Iowa's 9 AEAs on January 22nd that it was discontinuing the grants to fund the program. The $1.3 million grant pays for 18 employees statewide, including 16 full-time workers at two part-time workers. The program's employees work with the families of students with disabilities to make sure they understand the services that they can receive under state and federal law and serve as liaisons between families and school districts. The decision comes as Governor Kim Reynolds has proposed sweeping legislation to overhaul how the state's 9 area education agencies offer special education students to students, special education services to students and other supports to school districts. Reynolds' initial bill received widespread pushback. Republicans in the House and Senate have each proposed their own rewritten version of the legislation, but have yet to reach an agreement. Colin Crompton, a spokesperson for Reynolds, said that the state will seek to contract with an independent organization in place of the Family and Education Partnership Program. The Department of Education will no longer contract with the AEAs for Family Educator Partnership services and are exploring a partnership with an independent third-party entity to, The Department of, this is a quote from Compton, who is who's Governor Reynolds' spokesperson. The Department of Education will no longer contract with the AEAs for Family Educator Partnership services and are exploring a partnership with an independent third-party entity due to conflicts of interest presented by the AEAs. That's the quote from Compton, Governor Reynolds' spokesperson. Compton said that in a statement. The AEA's current grant cycle will not end until June 30th, 2024, allowing for an orderly transition. If any employees were terminated, this action was taken by the AEAs, not by the Department of Education, said Compton. Compton's statement did not provide details about what provider the state would contract with to replace the service. Cindy Yellick, chief administrator for the Heartland AEA in Central Iowa, said parents are disappointed the program will not continue. We're hearing a pretty significant outcry from parents about this, as is a service support that was highly valued to them and now is just gone, she said. And they have not heard what the plan is for if there's going to be another program, said Yellick. Compton said the fact that the Family and Educator Partnership coordinators are employed by the AEA creates a conflict of interest as they help families access resources. This creates a conflict of interest as the Family's Advocates is an employee of the same AEA providing the student services and supporting the school district to meet federal requirements, he said. Johanna Davis was a Family and Educator Partnership Coordinator at the Heartland AEA who resigned her position effective March 1 to take another job because of the decision not to renew the contract. Davis said she and other coordinators in the program do not view themselves as advocates. Instead, she said their role is to help parents understand the process and facilitate difficult conversations between families and school districts. We are not going in saying, this is what those parents want and you need to give it to them, she said. That's an advocate. We are an liaison piece. A big part of her job was helping parents understand the complex system of disability services that their students receive so the parents can be more involved, Davis said. When they're not informed and empowered, they can't be meaningful participants, she said. Yellick said the coordinators helped parents navigate the special education system and understand their due process rights. They could attend the individualized education plan meetings with parents if parents either were new to the system and felt like they wanted support, she said of the coordinators, or even if they had a disagreement with how the services were playing out, the person could go and help support the family in navigating that. A January 22nd email from Director of Special Education Barbara Guy to the 9 AEA directors simply said the state would not be renewing its contract agreement for the program. I truly appreciate the work your staff have accomplished to improve statewide special education services and supports for students and their families, Guy said in the email. I look forward to future collaborations for the benefit of those we serve, her email concluded. Yellick said she was not told explicitly if the state's decision not to renew the program was part of the governor's push to restructure the AEAs. It seems timing-wise that this is just part of how they're moving forward, she said, but we've never been explicitly told that this is a result of the bill. Compton said the move has no connection to the governor's proposal. He cited what he called unacceptable variances in support provided to families of students with disabilities. In fact, he went on to say, effective partnerships between families, educators, and community providers are critical in supporting the success of all students with disabilities across Iowa, Compton said in a statement. All families, no matter what AEA region they reside in, deserve to receive consistent services and high levels of advocacy support. While some families have received meaningful and impartial support, unfortunately, that's not been the experience of all families across Iowa, Compton's statement said. Yellick said a majority of the Family and Educator Partnership Program's employees will lose their jobs on July 1 if they have not already found other employment, like Davis. Heartland employs 3 coordinators in its programs, she said. The coordinators are generally parents of students with disabilities themselves and do not typically have the licenses as teachers or speech language pathologists that are required for most AEA jobs, Yellick said. They are not necessarily licensed teachers, so they don't have other positions to slide into, she said. Davis, who has 3 children, including 2 with autism, said she has been through the process with her own family, which gives her a unique perspective to help other parents. It's a really cool role to walk with another person, just to have somebody to kind of hold your hand and say, you can do it, and we can get through the hard things, she said. Davis said she's sad to leave the job, but needs to think of her family. I'm very, very sad, Davis said. I'm heartbroken to leave a job that is impactful and that I love, and it is very, very sad.
Senate okays bill regulating labels on meat alternatives. Lab-grown meat and plant-based meat alternatives could not be labeled as meat without including phrases like meatless or imitation on their labels under a bill that passed the Iowa Senate unanimously on Tuesday. Senator Don Driscoll, Republican of Williamsburg, dubbed the bill the Meat Integrity Act and said it would protect Iowa's livestock farmers from unfair competition from lab-grown meats and plant-based meat alternatives like Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers. Lab-grown products are emerging technology, Driscoll said, and the Fair Labels Act is an important first step for making sure that consumers understand the difference between lab-grown or plant-based products and real beef, pork, turkey, lamb, goat, and chickens raised by farmers and ranchers. The bill, Senate File 2391, passed the Iowa Senate on a 49-0 vote. It now goes to the Iowa House for consideration. The measure would prohibit food processing facilities from labeling meat alternatives like insect-based or plant-based substitutes as meat, and would also ban the use of common words like burger, drumstick, and bacon to describe meat alternatives, unless the product's label also includes a qualifying term like meatless, plant-based, or veggie. The bill would apply only to food processing facilities and would not impact grocery stores. The bill says that if the U.S. Department of Agriculture ever approves lab-grown meat to be purchased as part of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, that the state must submit a waiver seeking to exclude those products from what can be purchased using food assistance dollars. This is a preventative measure against an activist federal government who wants to see our children eat from a petri dish, said Driscoll, as Democrats audibly laughed. Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat of Des Moines, unsuccessfully offered an amendment to the bill that would have struck the portion of the bill dealing with food assistance programs, saying it unfairly prevents people receiving public assistance from buying food that anyone else would buy. "Why restrict because they're on food assistance?" Bisignano said. "It makes no sense. It divides and it labels people. And this would just allow them to buy the same things that you or I would be able to do." An Iowa food processing facility that misbrands a lab-grown meat product would face a civil penalty of between $500 and $10,000 per offense. The State Department of Inspections, Appeals, and Licensing, or a county inspector, could inspect food processing facilities if they receive a complaint. The bill also requires the Iowa Board of Regents, as well as community colleges and school districts in the state, to implement policies banning them from buying lab-grown meats.
Lawyers say that a gambling probe tool was misused. The creator of a tool that monitors online betting blocked the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation from employing the software after agents used it to probe college athletes' gambling and build a criminal case against them, attorneys for the players said in a court motion on Tuesday. According to the defense attorney's filing, GeoComply cut off the DCI's access to its system on January 26 after prosecutors brought charges against 25 athletes and student managers. The prosecutors have relied on evidence that a DCI agent gathered using GeoComply's tool, Kibana, which shows gambling activity linked to cell phone locations. The lead investigator, DCI agent Brian Sanger, testified in a January deposition that he did not apply for a search warrant before using Kibana, according to the defense attorneys. The lawyers for the players asked a judge in a motion Tuesday to suppress any evidence that the DCI gathered from Kibana, arguing that his use of the tool violated their client's Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches. According to the motion, GeoComply told members of the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission that the company was going to cut off the DCI's access to Kibana in October, a decision that the company allegedly carried out last month. "It had come to our attention that DCI may have exceeded the intended outlined scope of its Kibana access and use privileges," attorneys Van Plum, Matt Bowles, Tyler Alger, Christopher Sandy, and Michael Sandy wrote in the joint motion on behalf of four defendants. The lawyers also argued Tuesday that a judge should suppress any information that the DCI gathered from interviews with the players. According to a previous court motion, a DCI agent testified that he incorrectly told an athlete before an interview that the athlete was not the target of a criminal investigation. The athlete was a client of Sandy, and the other lawyers said in Tuesday's filing that DCI agents also told their clients that they were not targets of criminal probes. Those statements, that lawyers said, violated the player's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. The attorneys added that the DCI agents failed to read the players their required Miranda rights, which include instructing them of their right to remain silent. The coercive conduct and promises of leniency by the officers made any statements made involuntary, against free will, and contrary to the defendant's constitutional right, the lawyers wrote. The attorneys represent former Iowa State running back Jarrell Brock, wrestler Paniro Johnson, defensive lineman Isaiah Lee, and defensive end Ioma Uwazuriki. The Denver Broncos drafted Uwazuriki in the fourth round of the 2022 NFL draft, but the league suspended him last year when news of the gambling investigation broke. Representatives of GeoComply and the DCI did not immediately respond to emails from the Des Moines Register seeking comment Tuesday. On January 31, the DCI defended its investigation in a statement with a spokesperson for the division, saying that the Department of Public Safety conferred with legal counsel to ensure lawful access to and use of the technology. The evidence was obtained in a constitutionally permissible manner, the spokesperson said. Ultimately, it is up to the courts to decide. We want to reassure Iowans that the department always strives to scrupulously uphold the laws and constitutions of the United States and the state of Iowa, the spokesperson said. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd told WHO 13 on January 23 that she was not concerned about whether the DCI acted under proper authority. Those cases are not in my office, she said, and my understanding was the investigation was done by DPS, so they would be the ones who could answer that question, she added. A husband and wife who worked in the gambling industry launched GeoComply about a dozen years ago as online betting became more popular, according to the Wall Street Journal. The tech company uses double Wi-Fi signals, GPS, and cell tower signals to identify where users of sports books like FanDuel and DraftKings are placing their bets. Among other uses, the service is supposed to ensure that bettors are in the states where they claim to be, an important consideration because gambling laws vary state to state. According to the defense attorneys, GeoComply helps the Iowa Racing Gaming Commission ensure that sportsbooks enforce state gambling rules. They have said that GeoComply representatives trained DCI agents on how to use the software in 2022. In Tuesday's filing, the attorneys wrote that Sanger used Kibana to see whether people inside Iowa State Athletic buildings were placing bets. After he detected betting, the DCI subpoenaed sports books to get the names of the account holders tied to those bets. Sanger also received information on the credit cards and debit cards associated with those accounts. In some cases, that led to charges of identity theft because the players allegedly placed bets with accounts that belonged to other people, such as their mothers and girlfriends. Prosecutors also filed underage gambling charges against some defendants. Gamblers must be 21 in order to place bets in Iowa.
Trial begins in ex-anchor Heitschusen suit against WHO 13. All Sonja Heitschusen wanted, her attorneys say, was to be able to compete for her job on a level playing field with her colleagues. The longtime TV journalist and news anchor, who spent 17 years on the air for WHO 13 in Des Moines, is suing her former employer, accusing station leadership of ending her employment out of bias against putting older women in front of the camera. During opening statements of her trial Tuesday, her attorney, Tom Newkirk, told jurors that Heitschusen was an award-winning, proven ratings employee, but at age 53, no longer matched what her superiors were looking for when she was let go in 2020. Newkirk said WHO ignored its own employment policies and years of stellar employee reviews to target Heitschusen for her age and gender. When considering who to include in a statewide reduction in force, the company didn't even consider most of Heitschusen's male or younger female colleagues, he said, only looking to Heitschusen and several other women a few years behind her to make the needed cuts. Heitschusen, now Iowa State Auditor Rob Sands' spokesperson, was one of eight employees laid off after Nexstar Media acquired WHO in 2019. But while the mandate to cut costs and workforce came from the new owners, Newkirk said the company prides itself on absorbing local business models and executives into its system. The bias Heitschusen perceived against older female talent, he argued, was entirely homegrown. If the local station believes younger is better in front of the camera, then Nexstar is going to absorb that stereotype and apply it, he said. He also accused the company of going out of its way to hide news of the impending layoff from Hai-Chusen. The evidence will show they didn't want to ask her to take another job or take a pay cut because they were afraid she'd say yes, he said. Attorney Chris Hoym, representing the station and its management, didn't try to argue Hai-Chusen was fired for wrongdoing or poor performance. She was, he said, a very good anchor and reporter, as reflected in her performance reviews. But Hai-Chusen also was the third highest-paid newsroom employee, Hoym said. In her final years with WHO, she worked as co-anchor of the 4 and 5 p.m. broadcasts, but not the primetime 6 or 10 p.m. shows. Those facts made her an obvious choice when the directive came down from Nexstar to cut costs, he contended. Ms. Hai-Chusen was recommended to be part of the reduction in force because of those two reasons, her high compensation and the fact that station general manager Bobby Touch considered her to be an extra anchor who was not a dedicated anchor on the prime 6 and 10 newscasts, Hoym said. He also said Hai-Chusen received exactly the 120 days notice of her termination that she had negotiated in her contract and that she rebuffed multiple offers to help her find a new position at another Nexstar station. This difficult decision was not focused on performance, experience, and qualifications, he said. All the news anchors were good performers and qualified for their positions. Ultimately, Sonia Hai-Chusen was chosen to be part of a reduction in force along with 7 other employees within the station. The trial is expected to continue all week and into next week, with testimony expected from Hai-Chusen, Touch, and news director Rod Peterson. Several current WHO employees are expected to testify on Hai-Chusen's behalf, including former co-anchor Aaron Kiernan, whom the station sought before trial to block from testifying regarding her belief that she has been treated less favorably than male employees at times. The judge ruled Kiernan's testimony may be admissible and rejected the station's request.
And before we go into the birthday break, we'll look at some of the roundup of some of the state briefs from around surrounding states offered by USA Today. We'll start with the highlight, which is from Maine, York, Maine. A historic shipwreck that predates the American Revolution has again resurfaced from its place buried under Short Sands Beach. Beachgoers have been taking pictures over the last couple of weeks of what one researcher has claimed is the wreck of a ship believed to have been built in 1754. The ship resurfaces when weather events caused powerful tides to draw sand from the shore. Two major storms hit the seacoast on January 10 and January 13. The ship most recently was spotted in 2018 and 2020. It measures about 50 feet long, and some say it would be expensive and challenging to move and preserve. And from Rockford, Illinois. It's been more than a dozen years since Rockford's Dr. Gautam Gupta was placed on the FBI's most wanted list, and the doctor's exact whereabouts remain a mystery. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General's website, Gupta is among 133 individuals who are wanted for health care fraud and abuse or child support obligations. And from Minnesota in Bloomington, hundreds gathered to support former Republican South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley on Monday ahead of next week's March 5 presidential primary. The Haley campaign reported over 1,500 attendees filing into a space in the DoubleTree Hotel.